Today's Democrat Party is held hostage by haters, absolute haters, left-wing haters, angry mobs, deep state radicals, and their fake news allies.
It's time to expand your thinking. You will need to reset everything you thought you knew about the world, about the people you trust, about history, about yourself.
We look to the answer as to why for so many years we achieved so much, prospered as no other people on earth. It was because here in this land, we unleashed the energy and individual genius of man to a greater extent than has ever been done before.
Fellow Americans and citizens of the world, now it is our turn to shine. Wherever we are, we will become the plan when we choose to reject what they call globalism. We recognize the words they use to bend us to their will, and we say no more. It's time to turn off the media, follow your instincts, trust yourself, and be the plan. May God bless America and the world.
Hey, you know, on this show, I have not hidden my contempt for what masquerades as journalism in our country today. There are very few true reporters, very few true journalists, but there are legions of highly partisan, biased, and utterly dishonest hacks who serve up very pointed political patter instead of the truth. Hey, but don't take my word for it. Gallup and the Knight Foundation just released a massive poll on Americans' views of the media. It was a survey of more than 20,000 adults, and it found that pessimism about the news media delivering factual, nonpartisan, just decent information was a staggering 86% of Americans seeing at least a significant amount of bias in the media. 86%. 49% see a great deal of it, and 73% say there's too much bias in the reporting of news stories that are supposed to be objective. Now, Barry Weiss is a former opinion editor at the New York Times who abruptly resigned a couple of weeks ago with these parting words. I quote, "A new consensus has emerged in the press, but perhaps especially at this paper, that truth isn't a process of collective discovery, but an orthodoxy already known to an enlightened few whose job is to inform everyone else." She goes on. She says, "Twitter is not on the masthead of the New York Times, but Twitter has become its ultimate editor. Stories are chosen and told in a way to satisfy the narrowest of audiences rather than allowing a curious public to read about the world and draw their own conclusions." I end quote. Now, her entire exit letter was a stinging rebuke to the elitist snobs who run the New York Times. It is apparent they don't care. They live in their own version of la-la land. And then just this week, Arianna Pecori said she had all she could take at MSNBC, saying, and I quote her, "July 24th was my last day at MSNBC. I don't know what I'm going to do next exactly, but I simply couldn't stay there anymore. My colleagues are very smart people with good intentions. The problem is the job itself. It forces skilled journalists to make bad decisions on a daily basis." Now, then she quoted an anonymous, successful, and insightful TV veteran who said, quote, "We are a cancer and there is no cure. But if you could find a cure, it would change the world," end quote. Now remember, that is from someone who worked inside the belly of the beast at MSNBC, where there's not even a pretense of objectivity, fairness, or balance. And then there's the curious case of April Ryan, who actually has White House press credentials and who pretends to be a reporter, but who just this week crossed a line that historically precluded real reporters from being so blatantly biased. While flapping her jaws on CNN, she talked about, with joy, her dream of a Joe Biden inaugural day and said this about President Trump. Quote, if Joe Biden is now going to be the 46th president of the United States, it will be him being inaugurated and watching police and armed forces trying to pull Trump out of the White House. I cannot wait for that split screen. Well, I think the person who ought to be pulled forcibly out of the White House is April Ryan. That's who I think. After all, her hateful and bitter resentment of President Trump and those around him was so intense and personal that she once stepped over a really big line. She questioned whether my daughter, the former press secretary to President Trump, had actually baked a pecan pie for Thanksgiving. April Ryan clearly was ignorant of how uncouth it is to ever question a Southern lady as to whether she made her own pie. You don't do that. No. No, where I come from and where my daughter was raised, that's just not done by civilized people. Questioning the origin of a homemade pie is like questioning the legitimacy of a person's birth. But even as Ms. Ryan made this outrageous statement, not a single soul on CNN challenged her in her blatantly biased broadside. Now, these are just some examples in the past few days that reveal that the information fed to you by the mainstream media is unreliable. And it worries me for more than the outcome of the election. It worries me for the very existence of our country. But these revelations come with a warning that journalism as we once knew it has died, and it's been replaced with a kind of zombie reporting that's more the work of demolition to truth than gathering information for a free people so they can make up their own minds.
The establishment Republican psychodrama. In the last week or so, the snooty and snoozy salons of the anti-Trump Republicans have come to life in a heated debate over election strategy. Not about how to advance conservative principles or anything substantive like that. Instead, they're bickering over exactly how big of a win they want for Joe Biden. What's this all about, this never-Trump cult? Why are all these weird establishment Republicans like Joe Scarborough and Nicole Wallace and George Will trying so hard to get Biden elected and deliver the country to a Democratic Party that is rapidly being taken over by the loony left? They say it's about principle, but it can't be. They actually agree with the president on the big principles.
Conservatives do think we need to have a constant argument about the proper scope and actual competence of government.
Yes. And Trump has done more to actually limit the scope of government than any previous Republican president George Will supported, especially on tax and regulation. On immigration, when Joe Scarborough was in Congress, he voted to increase the size of the Border Patrol and build a strengthened border fence. No different to what President Trump has been doing. It is, however, very different to, in fact, the direct opposite of what a President Biden would do. The never-Trumpers say they believe in lower taxes, less regulation, smaller government. Biden wants higher taxes, more regulation, bigger government. For years, the never-Trumpers fought for school choice, controlled immigration, free speech and due process. Now they're fighting to shut down charter schools, open the borders, take away people's rights. And to try and make sure it happens, they're even working for a total Democratic takeover, House, Senate, the lot. Bizarrely, they're now targeting that well-known MAGA diehard, Senator Susan Collins of Maine.
Maine deserves a leader, not a Trump stooge. It's time for Susan Collins to go.
Senator Collins is one of President Trump's most vocal Republican critics. But whatever, the never-Trumpers want her replaced by a Democrat. These establishment Republicans are literally campaigning to abolish the legislative filibuster so the Democrats only need a simple majority, to give statehood to D.C. and Puerto Rico for a permanent left-wing Senate majority, to gerrymander districts so Republicans are shut out of power in Washington and state capitals, and to pack the Supreme Court so the left gets permanent control of the judicial branch add it all together, the socialist economics, the centralizing madness, the constitutional vandalism, it is a complete repudiation of conservative principle. The Never Trumpers can't possibly believe in it. So what's it all about, really? They say it's because Trump is corrupt.
It is an unprecedented level of corruption around this president, around this presidency, around Washington, D.C. Unprecedented in the modern era.
But if they're so concerned about corruption, why are they supporting Biden? He's the most corrupt politician to be nominated by a major party in the modern era. The puppet of his campaign donors, political controllers, and his family's employers. Biden didn't just corruptly abuse his office to enrich his son Hunter, as is well known, but as we have documented on Swamp Watch, his brother James, his other brother Frank, and his son-in-law Howard. If you care about corruption, the last candidate you'd support is Joe Biden. No, it must be something else. The Never Trumpers say the president is destroying America.
Donald Trump is a fatal and consequential moment, I think, not just for the party, but for the republic.
What are you talking about? Trump has kept America out of the wars that you Never Trumpers took us into. He built up the military that you depleted. He created jobs to replace the ones you destroyed. For American workers, he raised the wages cut by establishment Republicans to please the donors who made you rich, Steve Schmidt and Nicole Wallace and all the rest of the gang. You say Trump is a cruel racist.
He is, in his heart, he would appear to be a racist.
This is cruelty operationalized by an incompetent and vapid administration.
That was about separating families at the border. Totally unacceptable to Nicole Wallace. Except when her guy, President Bush, did it, albeit at a lower rate. She said there was nothing President Bush did that she wasn't emotionally invested in. These great crusaders for racial justice in the Trump era didn't seem to give two figs for black people when Bush was flying over New Orleans watching them suffer after Katrina, when Republicans sent them to jail in droves, destroying black communities and separating black families inside our borders. A wrong that was finally righted by this president, with thousands of black men serving unfair sentences now being released thanks to Trump's criminal justice reform, not to mention the unprecedented economic opportunities he created for black and Hispanic Americans. So if it's not really about racism or corruption or policy or principle or, in fact, anything of substance at all, what is it about? When you actually watch what they say and how they speak, you inevitably come to the conclusion that this whole thing, this entire Never Trump vanity project, and that's literally what it is about class condescension. They hate Trump and his supporters because of how they look and how they speak.
He's suffering because his coalition was very small, very white, and very angry.
That's partly him playing to their base and playing to their audience, the credulous boomer rube demo that backs Donald Trump.
Well, that's primary voters in the Republican Party have devolved into a Trumpist cult.
The Trumpist cult. They don't even know what they mean. They think Trumpism is something about tweeting too much. In fact, as we have consistently laid out here, the president has given the Republican Party a long overdue policy turnaround with a new conservative populism, pro-business on tax and regulation, pro-worker on trade and immigration. The establishment GOP was just one thing, pro-donor. The Never Trumpers are delusional if they think the Republican Party is going back to its corrupt past that made the rich richer, the workers poorer, and sold out America to China. But the Never Trumpers don't actually care about any of that. Joe Scarborough doesn't care about any of that. Joe Scarborough has no interest in policy or governing or substance of any kind. Joe Scarborough doesn't care about the black kids in charter schools whose opportunities will be destroyed by Biden and the Democrats. Joe Scarborough doesn't care about the small businesses that are going to be crushed as the regulations pile up. Joe Scarborough doesn't care about anything in the real world. He cares about the smug pats on the back from his self-righteous friends and his snooty little media bubble. For Joe Scarborough and George Will and Nicole Wallace and Anthony Scaramucci, it's all just vanity. They can afford a Biden presidency. They'll be fine under the sclerosis and stagnation of a Democrat economy. They are decadent dilettantes, ready to sacrifice working Americans' future for their social standing. No one's saying Trump is perfect. We've criticized him and his behavior on this show many times. But an election is not just another tweet or opinion piece in the New York Times. It is a choice about the policies that will affect millions of Americans. A vote for Biden will hurt working Americans, and a vote for Trump will help them, as it did before. In their hearts, the never-Trumpers must know that, which makes their actions even more unprincipled, incoherent, and indecent.
Joe Biden's announcement of Kamala Harris as VP, well, it contained a telling tidbit. This is what he said in the written statement. I've decided that Kamala Harris is the best person to help me take this fight to Donald Trump and Mike Pence, and then to lead this nation starting in January 2021. To lead this nation? Wasn't that you supposed to be on the top of the ticket doing all that leading for us, Joe? You know, that whole presidency thing? Come on, man. Even Joe's with it enough to understand that he's not really going to be running the show if he wins in November.
It has to be demonstrated that whomever I pick is two things. One, is capable of immediately being president because I'm an old guy, okay? No, but I'm serious.
Well, now that we know who will really be taking the reins in a Biden administration, let's take a look at what she'll do if they're elected. Today, the New York Times went the absurd route of touting the senator as a, quote, moderate. Of course, the opposite is the case. For starters, her position on illegal border crossings.
I believe if someone crosses over the border, it's illegally, it is illegal, and you would decriminalize it.
I would not make it a crime punishable by jail.
Of course not. Come on in. Bienvenidos. And what about taxpayer-funded health care for all those new undocumented Democrats?
Raise your hand if your government plan would provide coverage for undocumented immigrants.
Don't you love the hand raise questions? I love those. What about abortion?
I'm going to put in place and require that states that have a history of passing legislation that is designed to prevent or limit a woman's access to reproductive health care, that those laws have to come before my Department of Justice for a review.
That's called preclearance. That means partial birth abortion greenlit under President Harris. And she loves socialized medicine.
Do you think eliminating private insurance would be a socialist idea?
No. Okay, so I strongly believe that we need to have Medicare for all.
Do you think that's socialist or not, Medicare for all?
No. No, it's about providing health care to all people.
Yeah, it's worked out well for California, everything they're trying out there. And did I mention that Kamala also wants to take your guns away?
Upon being elected, I will give the United States Congress 100 days to get their act together and have the courage to pass reasonable gun safety laws. And if they fail to do it, then I will take executive action.
Yeah, reasonable gun safety. A little Kamala-ology needed there. Here come the guns. The Times also, by the way, called her pragmatic. We say that's fraudulent. Tulsi Gabbard exposed Kamala as a phony on criminal justice.
Now, Senator Harris says she's proud of her record as a prosecutor and that she'll be a prosecutor president. She put over 1,500 people in jail for marijuana violations and then laughed about it when she was asked if she ever smoked marijuana.
And I am proud of making a decision to not just give fancy speeches or be in a legislative body and give speeches on a floor.
The people who suffered under your reign as prosecutor, you owe them an apology.
Tulsi Gabbard just took her apart. Do you remember that debate? Now, furthermore, Senator Harris basically accused Joe Biden of being a racist on national TV.
It was hurtful to hear you talk about the reputations of two United States senators who built their reputations and career on the segregation of race. You also worked with them to oppose busing. And, you know, there was a little girl in California who was part of the second class to integrate her public schools. And she was bused to school every day. And that little girl was me.
That was the it moment. Well, after that, she very publicly suggested that Biden was guilty of sexually assaulting Tara Reid.
Somebody who has a relationship with Vice President Biden, what message would you give to the women who feel like their space has been invaded in the past by the Vice President?
I believe them, and I respect them being able to tell their story and having the courage to do it.
Do you believe that the Vice President should enter this race?
He's going to have to make that decision for himself.
Marinate in all that for a moment. Okay, essentially racist, at least in promoting all these past senators like Robert Byrd, friendships over, and implicitly, at the very least implicit, she was saying he was guilty of sexual assault, but now all of a sudden she's willing to work with him? A segregationist and a sex criminal? Oh, it's a good question. Maybe somebody in the lamestream media will have the courage to ask about this. But given all these issues, I've no doubt that the Biden campaign looked far and wide for a better option than Harris. But I guess there wasn't. It wasn't anyone. Susan Rice had way too much baggage and no election experience. Former Obama advisor David Axelrod said tonight Biden actually clicked best with Governor Whitmer. But she's not a woman of color and runs Michigan like a tin pot dictatorship. And the other candidates were political small fries without any type of experience or name recognition that you'd want in a VP. Of course, Biden's big mistake, of course, was narrowing his options by limiting his choice on the basis of skin color. And on planet Earth, that used to be called bias or even racism. Using color as a metric? Well, that's what he decided to do. And as someone running for the nation's highest office, Biden is morally obligated to pick the best person to take his place in the event of a tragedy, regardless of race or gender, of ethnicity, any of it. But he never even tried to do that. How cynical. Instead, he viewed the whole thing as a box-checking exercise for the woke crowd. He should have made his choice just on merit. But now he's stuck with Harris. The bottom line? She ran for president not so long ago and had a golden opportunity to present herself to liberal voters in the Democrat Party. But they rejected her in the most comprehensive manner possible, making it absolutely clear that they didn't regard her as worthy of serving as president. Now, in a desperate effort to please the hard left, Biden has rejected the judgment of his own party's voters and placed Harris in line to have all the power that Democrats thought she shouldn't have.
Democrats and White House negotiators reportedly not speaking since last Friday, this despite Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin saying that the White House is, quote, prepared to put more money on the table. Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell calling out Democrats for not finding any middle ground.
Families are suffering. Americans are dying. It would serve the nation better if the Democratic leaders would act like it's a crisis.
Joining me right now over the phone is Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin. Mr. Secretary, it's always a pleasure. Thanks very much for being here.
Maria, great to be with you as well.
Of course, the president did sign several executive orders to make sure the stimulus keeps on flowing for the American people. But can you tell us where the disagreement was with the Democrats and why a deal couldn't get done last week?
Well, Maria, you know, Mark Meadows and I left the meeting on Friday, and it was clear to us that Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer were just not willing to compromise. And as a result of that, we walked out, we called the president and said, look, it's time for you to move forward with executive action. And those executive action, they're very important. It's not everything we can do with legislation, but he guaranteed that there's unemployment benefits that will go to the states. But, you know, my view on a negotiation is you agree on the things that you can agree on, pass legislation that's good for the American public, and then come back always for another bill. And I think the Democrats are very focused on the politics. Perhaps they think that any deal is good for the president, and that's why they don't want to do it. But we agreed on money for schools, money for child care, money for small businesses, second payments on the PPP for businesses that have been particularly hard hit, more money for vaccines, hospitals. We even agreed to state and local aid, just not the ridiculous $1 trillion that they wanted.
So what about the aid to cities and states, the localities, which, of course, the Democrats want money to go specifically to cities and states? I know the president has talked about not wanting to reward certain cities that have had bad policies for years. Where are you on the money toward states?
Well, Maria, you know, the president understands the impact on state and local governments. And let me first start with, there's clearly been costs that the state and local governments have incurred as a result of COVID. And that's been our first priority. So in the first bill, we gave them $150 billion. That's more than enough money for the majority of the states. We gave them additional flexibility so that they could use that money for to pay firefighters, policemen, first responders, medical workers, so that they didn't have to lay off those workers. And most of that money has not been spent. Most of the states are sitting on a lot of that money. They want to use it for lost revenues. As part of our compromise proposal to the Democrats, we've said, okay, we'll create flexibility. You can't use that money to bail out pensions, but we'll let you use the historical money for lost revenues, and we'll put another $150 billion on the table. And that's an awful lot of money. That's $300 billion to state and local. We want to make sure that also that money gets down to cities and counties that are hard hit. It's not just held by the governors. And that will have a very good economic impact. And I think the issue is the way the Democrats come up with this $1 trillion is they look at the next 2 years, they project losses. They don't think the economy is going to open up. We do. And they look at some of their most problematic states, which had issues before all this.
Right, right, sure. What about cutting taxes? The president allowing businesses to defer payroll taxes through the end of the year with those executive orders over the weekend. He did float making those cuts permanent. I want to ask you about capital gains. Here's the president. Watch this.
We're looking very seriously at a capital gains tax cut and also at an income tax cut for middle-income families. I signed directives to give a payroll tax holiday with the understanding that after the election, on the assumption that it would be victorious for an administration that's done a great job, we will be ending that tax.
Secretary, what about that? Is the administration looking to implement further tax cuts ahead of the election?
Well, the president would like to do capital gains tax cuts, and we do need legislation to do what we want on that front. But if you go back and you look at the Taxpayer Relief Act of 1997, it reduced capital gains from what was 33% to 20%. It stimulated the economy tremendously. You then had in 2001 a further reduction to 18%, and in 2003 a further reduction to 15%. Including qualified deductions. And that stimulated tremendous investment in our economy, and that's what we need now because of COVID. So I think for the next few years, while we recover, we should reduce those capital gains. And I would just add that in 2003, Biden voted against the reduction of 20%. So, again, you see two very different economic policies. One is tax more and hurt the economy. One is create selective tax cuts, regulatory relief, and an economic agenda of trade that will stimulate the economy.
Senator Ron Johnson is joining us now for more on all of that. Senator, welcome. Good morning. Thanks for being here. So why have you subpoenaed Christopher Wray, the FBI director?
I finally ran out of patience. You know, certainly my committee wanted me, when they granted me this subpoena authorization, to try and get everybody's voluntary compliance, but it simply hasn't worked. The FBI continues to slow walk our request for documents, which really date back years. I sent a summary request to Attorney General Barr, who, by the way, has been great. The hang-up is within the FBI back in September 2019, basically relisting all the requests we had for information, and we really haven't got squat, basically. And what we're seeing now is we're seeing, you know, dribs and drabs. The most recent revelation is the a document that Lindsey Graham released on Sunday, which should shock people. I mean, the fact that a year after the FBI was fully aware of the fact that the Steele dossier was chock full of Russian disinformation, they're coming in front of the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence and briefing them falsely that they still had confidence in the Steele dossier. This is beyond the pale, and the FBI's got to come clean, and they've got to produce documents now based on our subpoena by August 20th. I'm done fooling around. Hopefully, we'll be able to engage counsel within the White House as well as the Attorney General's office to extract the documents out of the FBI. This is ridiculous.
Senator Lindsey Graham went on with our own Sean Hannity last night and said this. Listen.
On Ray's watch, the Senate Intel Committee was briefed about the dossier and the Russian subsource in the same fashion that the FISA court was briefed. Very misleading. The year after they knew the Russian dossier was no longer reliable, they told the same lies to the Congress, not just the court. It's a completely new front of legal liability, and I'm going to find out what happened.
Former Deputy National Security Advisor KT McFarland was on this program with us yesterday, Senator, suggesting that by what she knows and what she has seen, Christopher Wray is in deep trouble. Is he?
Well, let's face it, that briefing was a premeditated lie. This wasn't sort of, we just made a mistake. This was absolutely premeditated. Again, a year after the Steele dossier was used and known to be unreliable, that to contain Russian disinformation. That was my staff that found those classified footnotes in the Horowitz IG report that showed that the FBI was gaining information from October 2016 through February 2017 that showed how Russia was trying to infiltrate the Steele organization and literally planted Russian disinformation, the Steele dossier. And that was known. We never should have had a special counsel. The Crossfire Hurricane investigation should have been shut down probably no later than the end of January. And here we are, the FBI is briefing the Senate Intelligence Committee a year later. No, this is, again, beyond the pale. These were premeditated lies. And now all of a sudden, because Christopher Wray, it was on his watch, he allowed this to happen, he's going to have some real explaining to do as well.
So when KT explained to us why she believes that he's in big trouble, she laid out three scenarios. She suggested it was one, either he knew what was going on, two, he turned a blind eye and said, just don't tell me, or three, he's incompetent. You're digging to get that answer. Do you have a hunch at which it is?
It's the exact same thing I said about Rod Rosenstein when I heard his testimony. Either gross managerial incompetence, or he's trying to hide something, or again, he just simply doesn't recall. We're probably going to hear an awful lot of the "I simply don't recall," because that's a lot easier to say than "Oh no, I was involved in wrongdoing." We need to get to the bottom of this, which is why we need these documents, which is why I issued the subpoena.
Really quickly, Senator, is James Comey next?
Well, James Comey has an awful lot to account for. He's been pretty slippery. Remember, he was interviewed earlier. He refused to re-up his classification so that he couldn't answer certain questions. James Comey is no white knight here. He's got an awful lot of culpability in terms of what all happened. And think of the nightmare this country, the political nightmare we've gone through over the last 3 years because of the actions of these individuals. This is, again, something that needs to be exposed. The public needs to know what happened, and people need to be held accountable.
Senator Ron Johnson, appreciate you coming on this morning. Come back soon. Thank you.
Welcome back. Holding big tech accountable, Google cutting off ad revenue to right-leaning website Zero Hedge and also threatening the same for The Federalist. The company says the sites failed to meet Google's standards on offensive content. Missouri Senator Josh Hawley introducing legislation, meanwhile, that would remove immunity from big tech holding companies like Google, accountable for censoring different political viewpoints. We have heard from the Department of Justice as well. Joining me right now is Texas Senator, Senate Foreign Relations, and Senate Judiciary Committee member Ted Cruz. Senator, it's great to see you this morning. Thank you so much for being with me.
Good morning, Maria. Always good to be with you.
Your reaction to what has taken place at Google, and let me just point out that last week there were reports that Google had eliminated the image of Churchill, Winston Churchill. And then after there was a big, you know, hype about it, why would you eliminate Churchill's image? They said, oh, it was a mistake. Now you've got this pushback. back on the Federalist and Zero Hedge, basically threatening to rip off their advertising revenue, Senator.
Now, that's exactly right, and it's worth noting the power that Google has amassed. It's unlike anything we've ever seen in history. There's never been a company that controls more information and critically more access to information. Over 90% of the searches done are done through Google, and their control of search, their control of ad revenue, has the ability to control what the American people hear, learn, understand, and in this instance, they really abuse that power.
But joining me now is a governor who refused to give in to the left's demands and lockdown requests, Governor Kristi Noem of South Dakota. Governor, it's great to have you on tonight. You have been lambasted in the press for not stripping your residents of their basic freedoms and their right to work and go to school. But here we are about now 6 months into this pandemic, and South Dakota still has a death rate 11 times lower than New York's per 100,000 people. Amazing.
Yeah, we're doing very well, Laura. And that's really the story that needs to be told, is that I trusted my people. They trusted me. They took personal responsibility for dealing with this virus. And we're doing very well. Not only do we have one of the lowest death rates, we've got about 40 people that are in the hospital today statewide. Our infection rates are low. Our job losses are low. Our economy is doing better than virtually any other state. And I think it's a real testimony to what could have been possible in many of these other states. The governors just made the wrong decisions.
Well, despite this overwhelming evidence, Governor Noem, including, as you just said, from your state, the left is still urging national lockdowns. Watch.
Lockdowns work. Quarantine works. Isolation works. Wearing masks work. Contact tracing works. These things work, and we're not doing them.
If we were to lock down hard for a month or 6 weeks, we could get the case count down so that our testing and our contact tracing was actually enough to control it.
Governor, your state proves this is just not the case, and we don't need to strip the people of their freedom to fight the virus.
You know, what works is washing your hands, making good decisions. I think what we're seeing there is encouraging leaders to make decisions that where they will overstep their authorities in a time of crisis. And that's how we lose this country, Laura. That is exactly what's happening, is that we are allowing them to take control of our country in a way that we haven't seen before. So we need a few people to stand up, read our history, talk about the importance of our Constitution and the fact that these governors need to recognize that they need to uphold those freedoms that we hold so dear and allow these people to take care of their families and make the right decisions and deal with this virus much like we do every other challenge that comes our way and Americans tackle it together. What I'm frustrated by is just the go ahead.
Sorry, what would have happened to your state's economy had we listened to this Dr. Hazeltine or any of these other officials, Neil Kashkari at the Fed? I don't know why he's supposedly an expert at this, but what would have happened to your economy and your people?
Well, they would have been devastated. We would have lost businesses. Families would have lost their homes. We would have seen so many more people still continue to get sick, still be hospitalized, but they'd be doing it with less resources to take care of each other and less of an ability to really go forward and provide for their families. So that's the challenge here, is that our state is so diverse. We have very urban areas, but we also have very rural areas. And a blanket approach doesn't make sense for the entire state of South Dakota. It doesn't make sense for this entire country. And that's why we need local leaders to trust people in their communities to make the decisions that work best for them. And we also need them to be optimistic, Laura. I mean, this negativity that we hear from leaders and doctors about how terrible the situation is in our country, we're in a good spot. We are driving down our death rates. The virus is moving across the country, but we're taking care of people. They're getting the resources. The administration has helped governors respond to their people. I worry about these kids that turn on the news and hear their parents talking about being scared and hear news anchors talking about being worried and doctors. We wonder why our kids are struggling with anxiety. Let's be optimistic.
There's concern about this big motorcycle rally that's happening this weekend in South Dakota. And we don't have to play the soundbite. Oh, my God, on television, all the cable news. How dare you? It's going to become a super spreader event, Governor, a big super spreader event. Look at all those people. Look at how they gather.
Well, we've had several big events in South Dakota already. We had the first spectator attended professional sport. The professional bull riding was held in South Dakota. We had the July 3rd event and saw no increase in cases because of that crowd that gathered to celebrate our country's freedom and independence. People have been gathering. We've been back to normal for over 3 months here in South Dakota. So we know we can have these events, give people information, let them protect their health, but still enjoy their way of life and enjoy events like the Sturgis Motorcycle Rally. We hope people come. Our economy benefits when people come and visit us.
Well, lucky residents and citizens of the great state of South Dakota, because we're stuck in the D.C. metropolitan area with horrible leadership. Yeah. And Governor, we just wish you the best of luck this weekend and going forward, and check back with us soon.
Ted Cruz of Texas chaired an important hearing on the violent rioters plaguing liberal-run cities for decades all across the country. Portland, Oregon, for example. For weeks, we have seen unhinged agitators attacking law enforcement, destroying the federal courthouse, unleashing a wave of destruction coast to coast. Here's Senator Cruz from earlier today.
Denying fair protection of law enforcement is a civil rights violation. Those rioters aren't concerned about racial justice. Indeed, they're willing to make a mockery of the peaceful protest to advance their violent objectives. More and more, we're seeing signs that a significant portion of this violence, of this rioting, is not random. It's not spontaneous. Rather, it is coordinated and inspired by leftist anarchist groups, groups like Antifa. We're seeing too many local officials, mayors, and governors who've made a cynical decision that it's in their partisan interest to turn a blind eye to this violence. I would also note that the ranking member said nobody is condoning the violence and rioting, and yet nowhere in the opening remarks was even one word condemning it.
Senator, welcome back to the program. I want to read something else you said today, and I'm going to get to that comment in a second. You said, First Amendment, you're a constitutional scholar. Alan Dershowitz of Harvard, you went there, said one of the best students he's ever had and one of the best debaters. You said the First Amendment guarantees freedom of speech, the right for people to peacefully assemble, but peacefully assembling matters a great deal in that protection, and peaceful protesters must be protected. Riots must be stopped. They're not stopping it, Senator.
Not only are they not stopping it, they're facilitating it. Look, at the end of the day, this isn't complicated. The First Amendment protects our right to speak. Every one of us has a right to speak. We have a right to protest. What the text of the First Amendment provides is it protects our right peaceably to assemble and to petition the government for redress of our grievances. What's happening, unfortunately, it is not free speech, and those who are peaceably protesting are seeing their protests hijacked by violent anarchists, by Marxists who are engaged in acts of terror. At the end of the day, none of this is complicated. Don't assault your fellow citizens. Don't firebomb a police car. Don't loot and destroy small businesses. Don't murder police officers. And Sean, I got to tell you, it was striking in about 4 hours of a hearing today in the Senate Constitution Subcommittee that I chair. Seven Democrats spoke and questioned the witnesses. Not a single one dared to criticize Antifa in any way, because they're making a cynical decision that they want to encourage these radical leftists who are assaulting and threatening American citizens. It's really unfortunate.
Let me go to what that point you made and what we just played and what you just said, the cynical decision that it's in their partisan interest to turn a blind eye to violence. And, you know, and then you went on to say to throw out terms like stormtroopers, Gestapo, to describe federal law enforcement. Let me put on the screen the comments of Nancy Pelosi. She compared our federal law enforcement to stormtroopers. And that, now let me play Senator Clyburn. First, he made a Nazi comparison. Then later, well, then he compared the president to a fascist, a Mussolini. And then Jerry Nadler says it's a myth. This is violence that we see with our own eyes. It isn't happening. Let me play that for you.
And this president and this attorney general seem to be doing everything they possibly can to impose Gestapo activities in local communities, and that is what I have been warning about for a long time.
There's violence across the whole country. Do you disavow the violence from Antifa that's happening in Portland right now?
That's a myth that's being spread only in Washington, D.C.
About Antifa in Portland?
Yes.
Sir, there's videos everywhere online. There's fires and riots. They're throwing fireworks at federal officers. DHS is there. Look online. It gets crazy, Mr. Nadler.